This is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Skip Stewart, Vice President and Chief Improvement Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brad Parsons, Vice President of Market Operations at Baptist.
And I'm Bill Cloud, Assistant Chief Medical Officer at Baptist.
Well, folks, we have a wonderful guest today. We have Dr. Douglas Slakey, and we're going to talk about his new book, The Process Manifesto, Improving Healthcare in a Complex World. Well, Dr. Slakey, thank you so much for joining us. Would you tell our guests a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure, Skip. And Brad and Bill, it's really a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me and including me in the podcast. So, abdominal transplant surgeon by training, liver, kidney, pancreas, and small bowel, and a lot of complex hepatobiliary surgery over the years. I had really a blessed career. I was fortunate to work and operate in several countries around the world. For example, I did the first laparoscopic living donor in Europe, which is a whole nother story. I wasn't sure they'd let me out but it turned out to be a perfect case. And then I was at Tulane University in New Orleans for 21 years of my career, initially built the transplant program. And again, a really great team I worked with. We did some really innovative things. And then 20 years ago this month, Hurricane Katrina hit, and after Hurricane Katrina, I was asked to take over the chair of surgery position. And so, you know, that was kind of a really pivotal point for me. Although I was still very clinically active, I started really thinking about, you know, how can we rebuild healthcare in the Gulf South, and how can we overcome some of the limitations with access and mistrust of the system that we saw? And how can we even think in terms of collaboration? As you know, a lot of people left New Orleans. Tulane Hospital was flooded and didn't reopen until February of 2006. So we had to think about thin resources and how do we care for patients? And also, how do we encourage people to come back and give them the confidence that they'd have, in the case of physicians and nurses, have a career, a place to work. So I did that. And then 2018, I was recruited up to Chicago, and I was the chief of surgery at Advocate Aurora for, at the time, 27 hospitals with a focus on high reliability. They were on a high reliability journey, and we did some really great, great work. I had a really good team. And then after that, I took a short sabbatical, wrote the book, Process Manifesto, that you alluded to. And then just over a year ago, I was recruited here to Nashville, to Belmont University, to help open Thomas F. Frist Jr. College of Medicine and to chair health system science. I decided in my own mind I'd probably done enough transplants to last two or three lifetimes. So although I miss the patients, I don't miss being up all night. And I thought I could really use my experience to contribute with a particular focus that I think we'll talk more about. How do we leverage modern technology and modern leadership theory and education to empower people on the front lines of care, both on the provider side and on the patient? And I like to say the person health journey side. So here in Nashville for a year and really excited about what we're doing.
Dr. Slakey, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you. And so you're just right down the road. You're full-time in Nashville now?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, it's not much of a drive. And so we're really excited about collaborating with you and kind of hearing about more about your work and the book that you got, The Process Manifesto. Let's start with the title of the book. You know, there was another book under a similar title that used manifesto. Tell us a little bit about how you got there.
Well, so I'll take a step back to the time immediately after Hurricane Katrina, when I started thinking about, you know, what are the elements of high reliability theory that could really be applied to healthcare, and how should we think through it? And at the time, it was sort of funny. I started writing about it and publishing a few things, and I'd go to some of the large surgical meetings, and everyone would say, wow, Doug, that's really great, but we're fee for service. How does this really relate to us? So what I did was I used end-stage renal disease as a model, and I put together a team that included people from the airline industry, the petroleum industry, interestingly enough, NASA, and, you know, healthcare workers. And we went to emerging market countries. We actually had grants from the U.S. State Department, USAID, believe it or not, and then also industry. And we helped emerging market countries find strategic ways to improve their ability to deliver care without negatively impacting the budget. And they were sustainable results. It was really fascinating to me. And what I realized from that was that we were really foundationally thinking about what are the processes that we need to influence and train teams to influence that could then be sustainable and scalable over time, and contributing to both the goal of optimizing patient outcomes and also being sensitive to the economic realities. And so emerging market countries are interesting, of course, because they tend to be a single payer system. And so there's an end-stage renal disease is a easily identifiable patient population, of course. So it was a great model to experience. And so that just led me down a path that I had never anticipated. And I realized, and something we might delve into a little bit more, is that processes in healthcare are particularly interesting because we have to deal with people, and people are not predictable. So by definition, there's a complex nature which underpins the delivery of healthcare. And I think one of the fallacies and maybe pitfalls that we've seen over the last two or three decades is that in many instances, we've tried to reduce complexity to a linear representation of reality, a highly predictable model that we think we can fully understand and control. And while that may be appropriate for something like registration or, you know, certain aspects of highly reproducible processes, human beings are not like a car on an assembly line. And when we try to force people into a linear representation that they know is not representative of reality, I argue in my book that some of what we see with frustration and burnout and early quitting and even mistrust of the system is related to that. So that's where the book title came from, is that I argue that leaders, managers, really everyone within the system has to think of processes in terms of realism. And that must, if we're going to deal with human beings, that must incorporate complexity and a realization that there are aspects that we're never going to be able to fully control.
Yeah, Dr. Slakey, that is really, really good. We've been kind of on a journey, and I even personally, I'm on a journey of really understanding complexity, because we talk about healthcare often as the most complex thing ever created. And I believe it is. But we've got this, it's not just understanding it ourselves, but how do we get all of our teams to understand the complexity at play with a bunch of interconnected processes that are happening. So I'm really intrigued in hearing about your book. And is that where you got to in 2019, 2020, when you decided you wanted to write this?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I'd had a lot of people around the world, you know, come up to me after a talk or after a seminar and say, you have to write a book. And of course I'm like, okay, well, that's nice. but it really got to the point where I thought, you know, I think this exercise in putting these thoughts into words in a book could actually lead to, just like today, some interesting conversations and get people thinking. And at the end of the day, and one of the reasons why I am excited about my current role as the chair of health system sciences, and then I also founded just actually a few months ago now, in less than a year, a global collaborative that we call the Collaborative for Health System Innovation. It's all part of that. So here's the bottom line at the end of the book is I advocate for a couple of high level but practical solutions. And I truly believe it has to begin with education. And sometimes we discount education as really the foundational element upon which we build skills, including management and leadership skills. You know, in healthcare traditionally, and I wrote a paper about this when I first became a surgical chair, I said, you know, how do we traditionally pick surgical chairs? Because we considered them experts in the operating room. But how do we equip people with tools for being leaders and understanding things like complexity?
And do we don't, really, right?
No, we don't. We don't invest in that. We don't, you know, we say, yeah, we want you to still do those, you know, 10 transplants a week. But by the way, we want you to be a leader of 45 people and manage a budget of $40 million. And you're like, oh, wow, that's a big step. So education is critical. And I think we are truly at a point where we have to honestly consider how we're educating the next group of healthcare professionals, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, and others. You know, we're still, so let's start there. We still, and it's understandable because of the boards and things, we still teach people to memorize. And, you know, traditionally, when you look at a physician's stature and the view of a physician as an expert, much of that was predicated upon a belief that they had a command of knowledge relative to their specialty. Well, we all know with modern technology and the pace at which knowledge is expanding, that it is completely unrealistic to expect a human being to have a comprehensive command of anything. So one of the things I really believe we need to do with education, I talk about this a little in the book, is that we need to move from a focus on memorization to mastery and the ability to gather and interpret information. That's going to be critical. So important. So there's education and training, which we talk about lifelong education, but we really have to commit to it, right? And it can't be always at 6:30 in the morning with a computer-based training before you go to the operating room at 7. That's not completely effective. So education training is critical, and that has to include an understanding of data resources and inferencing and how we're changing. And then the second thing is to really encourage leaders and managers to set up guardrails for consistency, but within those guardrails to empower people on the front lines of care to use their education training, the situational awareness, and the ability to align resources with need, and that's critical, align resources with need at the point of care delivery. I could give so many examples, but, you know, because of this sort of focus on reducing things to linear standards, we tend to tell everybody the same thing. Like take a person with hypertension, heart disease. What do we tell them about diet? We say, well, eat a Mediterranean diet.
Right.
Well, what does that mean? If you have the third generation person from Okinawa, Japan, which, by the way, is one of the blue zones, the first one discovered, why should we tell them to eat a Mediterranean profile diet? That makes no sense culturally, ethically, or anything like that. And, you know, as physicians, we print out our 2 or 3 pages of food recommendations or exercise recommendations. And, you know, we give the exact same thing to the third generation white Presbyterian in Maine that we give to the first generation Hispanic in San Antonio. And then we wonder why it doesn't work.
Why isn't that working?
And so, again, that's that layers of complexity and situational awareness. And furthermore, you know, within the construct of healthcare, what do we really know about our patients' lives outside of our clinics or our hospitals or our operating rooms? You know, here's one good example. We've done amazing work with diabetes, right? I mean, I remember when I started as a surgical resident, we were doing amputations on, you know, 24-year-olds, and people were going blind by 26 with juvenile onset diabetes, and you really don't see that much anymore. So the average person with diabetes in the United States directly interfaces with the healthcare system 6 or 8 hours a year. That's where we capture all our data. Right? Those 6 to 8 hours, that's our database. Well, there's 8,760 hours in a year. So who are we to take that 6 or 8 hours of information data and think that we understand the other 8,754 hours the person's living? It's absurd on the face of it, right? And so we have to flip the script on that, and we have to be able to better manage complexity by understanding that longitudinal reality of people who interface with our health system. So I apologize, I threw a lot out there.
No, that's great.
But those are some of the things that are top of mind that really resonated with me when I was trying to put the book together.
So Doug, tell us a little bit about how writing the book has led you to where you are now.
Yeah.
With the thoughts about the collaboration, what is the goal of the collaboration you're putting together?
Yeah. So with the, I think the journey with the book was, it's an interesting intellectual exercise to actually, you know, sit and try to put your words on paper. And I will say, although I'm both a fan of like Dostoevsky, I'm also very much a fan of F. Scott Fitzgerald and Hemingway. And I realize, The Great Gatsby is like 46,000 words. So I committed myself to trying to figure out what could I say in 45 or 50,000 words, as opposed to, you know, thinking I needed to write 300,000 words. And actually, Bill, that exercise, much like doing something like a TED Talk, that exercise of focusing your thoughts into a concise and usable format is more difficult than one would imagine, but it's very useful. And that exercise really got me thinking that, you know, I had, I believe, a bit of a unique perspective. I've been an incredibly busy physician. Like I said, I've been very fortunate, worked with some great people, done a couple thousand transplants and a whole lot of other surgery. And I've seen these different layers of things. And I thought, you know, one of the things that sometimes is missing, and I think it's true, especially today with the explosion of AI and the tech world, is that there's a disconnect between people who have lived on the front lines and can advocate for those on the front lines versus very well-meaning people who have great ideas, but they don't always truly appreciate what it's like to do that work. They might know it superficially, but, you know, unless you've gone 36 hours without sleep and, you know, probably operated to a point of exhaustion where you shouldn't have been, it's hard to put that into context. And so I saw an ability to make this career pivot and say, you know, I could take this experience and I can be a translator between the needs of the frontline and also the reality of that whole person health journey. And then leadership and technology And how can we put those together and really make a difference? So with the collaborative, I specifically wanted it to be not transactional as its foundation, meaning business opportunities, while they may well come to fruition, that's not our reason for existing. Our reason for existing is to bring people together into a collaborative ecosystem to design, research, ideate, and scale innovation. And I think scaling is so important. And sometimes we miss that in academics, where we really think, well, how do we scale beyond our institution and beyond sort of a narrow vision of success?
Dr. Slakey, we've talked a little bit about it, but you mentioned it now twice, I believe. But how do you see technology kind of coming alongside this need for processes in a complex environment?
Yeah. Well, I see it from two different perspectives. So I think one, which arguably is the most practical and where most of the, entrepreneurial focus is how do we take existing paradigms and make them more fluid and more efficient and more driven by not data. I like people to think not in terms of data, because we have tons of data, but what we don't consistently have is insight. So it needs to be, that's the future, is how do we turn this data into true insights? You know, and I think for everybody, whether you're managing an area in the hospital or a clinic, or whether you're the provider on the front lines, having that insight is what's going to make a big difference. So I think that's one big focus. The other big focus, which is a little bit more transformative in vision and maybe a little bit scarier for some people that are committed to the current system, is to really rethink how do we view the personal health journey. And I like to use the term person health journey as opposed to patient, because arguably when someone becomes labeled a patient, our current system is set up to view them more as a commodity. And the system is largely designed to control the patient, right? Where's the data sit? You know, we want people within our healthcare system, on the one hand, because we think we're hopefully delivering the best care. But on the other hand, that's part of the business model, right? Is how do you control that? And again, going back to my diabetes example of the reality of the hours in and outside the healthcare system, it's that whole person journey. So one of the critical things that I'm very engaged in is thinking, how can we leverage agentic AI to help people curate a life health journey that makes sense to them, their lived reality, the context in which they truly exist, and then how can that in turn empower our healthcare professionals and healthcare systems to be more efficient and effective. So moving really from episodic view of care delivery, which we've done remarkable things, right? Like you have a stroke center and you can get somebody from the front door to the cath lab in 30 or 32 minutes and save lives. I mean, that's remarkable. But what have we really done to address the root incidence of stroke and chronic disease? We know that despite $4 trillion a year in healthcare spending, the incidence of every single chronic disease has gone up. I can't think of one which has gone down. And even things like cancer, you know, we're seeing colorectal cancer in younger and younger individuals that were unheard of when, you know, Bill and I trained. You know, it was a disease of 55 and older, and now it's a disease of 40-year-olds. So anyway, we have to grapple with that, and we have to think in terms of how can we really move the needle on health outside of the four walls of our facilities.
Could you talk about what are some specific areas you've begun to look at in terms of the personal health journey at Frisco?
Yeah. So we've got a couple of really interesting prototypes that we're actually working on in partnership, for example, with Cisco, and they've been very supportive. We're doing a maternal fetal health project in Middle Tennessee for underserved people. Now, this really encapsulates my thought process. So when you think of maternal fetal health, you're thinking, okay, well, as soon as someone becomes pregnant, I want to get them in a clinical pathway. Well, flipping the script, we said we want to take the population of Middle Tennessee and we want to predict which women are most likely to become pregnant in the next 24 to 36 months and partner with community organizations and providers to start to engage them and build trust before they become pregnant.
About that.
And then be able to curate resources so that once they become, so hopefully they're better prepared for pregnancy because they have trust and resources that can help them as they reach that point, even if it's unexpected, right? Even if it's not a planned pregnancy. And then immediately we have trust with community organizations and providers and this patient group. So how can we then align resources with need when the need arises, not as a crisis management tool, oh my gosh, we got to do something, but something which we have prepared for and predicted for. And I think that's a great example of how we're thinking somewhat outside of the traditional clinical pathways. And I think that's a good illustration of moving from a linear pathway that's triggered by the person knows they're pregnant, which, let's be honest, some people don't know they're pregnant for 2 months or longer. And of course, we're all faced running health systems of women, unfortunately, coming to the emergency room in labor with no prenatal care. So we know the current system has limitations. So how can we leverage technology to find new ways? So that's a great example of one that we're working on. We also are starting some really interesting conversations with youth sports and injury prevention. So imagine if you had an adolescent playing soccer there in the suburbs of Memphis, and we told you you could have an agentic AI agent that was trained on Ronaldo's diet and exercise and sleep. And I think a lot of us would say, wow, that could be a really amazing tool.
Very cool. And
for both of those, you know, not only do we have protections in place for individual healthcare data, but we're also working to look at how we can aggregate de-identified data. And this, we probably don't have time for this, but another thing with technology is I firmly believe we're going to move from a deterministic null hypothesis, you know, binary choice, which has really been the hallmark of our clinical trials, to ones that are much more inferential and probabilistic in the way they look at large data sets. And I think that's going to be revolutionary in areas like cancer care, cardiac care, and others as we move forward. So anyway, that's one example of where we're going.
So talk about how you talk about the binary world and we're going to have a control group and this sort of thing. That's sort of the way we define outcomes. So we know, like specifically with the maternal fetal population, you're talking about infant mortality and some of the well-defined kind of either it's a plus or a zero.
Yeah.
What are some outcomes you think you would be looking at to measure the impact of that intervention?
Yeah, well, for sure, all the traditional measures that people look at, including World Health Organization definition measures, those are obviously critically important. And then we're also looking at the individual's perspective of trust in the system and the support network that they have. Like, what's their individual perspective? And I think we know, you know, there's good data that particularly coming out of the pandemic, that trust of the system has diminished on so many levels, you know. So I think you have to continue to measure those traditional outcomes, including cost. They're incredibly important. And one of our hypotheses is that if we can use education and community resources and alignment of resources at a more appropriate time, that for our health system partners delivering this care, we can reduce the cost burden for them. We can reduce length of stay, reduce NICU admissions, and that sort of thing. I will say on an editorial note that this is something that fascinates me, because if some of these strategies really work, we're going to have to rethink the way that our hospitals function. And I'm the eternal optimist, so I think it's good, because just like you want your healthcare providers, physicians to be working at top of license, you want your fixed healthcare assets to be working at top of license. You don't want to be inundated in the emergency room with, you know, the respiratory virus that could be managed as an outpatient, right? We want our hospitals to be dealing with the transplants, the strokes, the cancer, and maternity, those things that truly have to be done, even if for a short length of stay in our facilities. And I think we know that these changes are coming, right? Where we talk about hospital at home, we're all more comfortable with telemedicine to one degree or another, remote patient monitoring. So we know we've got all these elements out there. It's just, how do you curate them, and how do you make sense within the scheme of a process to look beyond the day-to-day siloed results in our independent operating units? I'm not saying it's easy by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, the leaders of healthcare in the future are going to have to grapple with these realities. There's no question in my mind. So a lot of what we're doing with the collaborative is a huge focus on education, both of the novice learner, the medical students, but also of existing leaders and people in practice. And how do we start to engage them, not to necessarily give them all the answers, rather to get people thinking outside perhaps of their comfort zone and starting to really think, well, how can we explore some of these different opportunities and set ourselves up for success, as opposed to being victims of realities that are moving beyond our control.
Well, Dr. Schlaike, that was fantastic. And if it wasn't for time, I could ask a ton of questions. I'm so appreciative that you at the very beginning talked about what we would call the most complex socio-technical system on planet Earth. I just think that because we're dealing with humans, that makes the system that much more complex. But I'm going to wedge in one question, because I'm just too tempted not to. I'm assuming, have you also discovered, as you've thought about, as you've researched, that there's certain characteristics that when they're not present, allows entropy of the systems to accelerate, meaning that the reason that sustainment maybe hasn't always been able to be kept in place is because certain characteristics that other industries have adopted over time still kind of elude and haven't made its way into healthcare.
Well, Yes. So I have actually a simple answer to that question, which is not the total answer, but I think one of the big challenges that I ask healthcare leaders and managers to think about is how do we make sure that our key performance indicators and our metrics within our operational units are aligned with the ultimate mission and goals of our institutions. And I think of all the things that most lend themselves to being correctable on a day-to-day basis is misalignment there. You know, we have key performance indicators that we hold people accountable to that if you think beyond those individual operating units, we see effects which might be predictable even that are contrary to our goal of providing the best, most consistent patient care. And I think that's, you know, on a day-to-day practical perspective, aligning key performance indicators with quality goals has to be a starting point. And we have to all agree, what are those quality goals we're trying to achieve as a team? And that, of course, speaks to institutional culture and kind of wraps everything together. But hopefully that was a good succinct answer to your question. But I'd love to leave everyone with that thought as they look at their budget and their KPIs and how they're managing across those.
Really good, Dr. Schlakey. It was fantastic. Actually, I can already see another podcast coming on where we'd love to have you back. But as of for today, you know, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you on behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare for just having this conversation. Thank you for the hard work that you had to do to write that book and to think through those thoughts. And just so grateful for you and the work you're doing. And on behalf of Baptist, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It was an honor to participate. I really appreciate it.